Hi, everybody, and welcome to another Robcast. And I am so excited about this one because Thomas Moore is with us. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And is it Thomas or Tom?
Either one. I like both.
Your work has affected so many people, and I've been a fan at a distance. So to talk to you about all the things and questions I have is just really exciting. So we're sitting in a hotel room overlooking the ocean, and you're here in Los Angeles?
Yes.
Speaking, relaxing, what are you up to?
I was giving a few talks. I gave a talk for a group called Still Point in Pasadena, and that was terrific. And then Sunday I gave a talk to the Jung Institute of LA, and that was wonderful. Just a great, very excited people and a nice big crowd, and we had a great time. And then I went to Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena.
Sure. I've been there. Mm-hmm. So let's go way back. You grew up in Detroit.
Yeah.
At 13, you start studying to become a monk?
Well, yeah, I did. I left home at 13. I went to Chicago, where there was a what would be called a seminary for the high school level. But actually, even in high school, it was really a monastic style of life. We meditated and had a lot of liturgy, ritual, and studied Latin and Greek a great deal, kind of a classical education. So it was being away from home and being dedicated to this long process. It would be a 13-year process to become a priest. So it was like a two-layered kind of experience. So part of it was to study to become a priest, and the other part was, right from the beginning, living a monastic style of life.
At 13?
At 13.
And so at 13, did you know you were committing to 13 more years?
Yes.
And you were fine with it?
I was. I mean, I didn't know what that implied. I mean, I wasn't old enough to even figure it out totally. But I was excited about it. I had spent a lot of time in my childhood around priests and nuns, and it was just a natural thing for me to want to be part of it. I think those were the people I admired the most. They were the most interesting people in my life. I lived with my parents in a working class section of Detroit, and my dad taught plumbing all his life. He was a born teacher, and he taught plumbing. Most of my uncles were plumbers, so that was my background. And so for me to leave home was entering a much bigger world.
Yeah. And even at 13, you knew that much.
I did. I knew that much. I don't think I knew anything beyond that. But I knew enough that something in me wanted to break out and do something bigger.
And so then you're there for 13 years?
I was there for about 13 years, yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, shortly before I was to be ordained, I'd say 4 or 5 months, maybe 6 months before I was to be ordained, it suddenly dawned on me. I mean, the way I feel it, my memory is I woke up one morning and whatever it was that had got me into that life now was taking me out. It was that same kind of experience. It was something stirring inside me. There were no good external reasons to leave. I loved the life. I was ready to get into it. My family was all behind me, and they had kind of suffered with me going through all of that. And yet, I knew it was gone, and I didn't want to get into something that wouldn't be right. So I left.
And you're at this point mid-20s?
Yeah, 26.
And what did you go do?
Well, I had studied music when I was in this monastic life. The music was a big thing for me. And I taught myself composition. I read a lot of books on composing. But I had studied theory with music theory with some really good professors from the university, nearby university. I was pretty well educated in music at that point. So I went on, I finished my degree in music, a bachelor's degree, and then I went to the University of Michigan, which had a wonderful school of music. And I studied composition and musicology there, and I really enjoyed it. But I missed theology. And I missed, when I left that life, I really left religion. But When I found myself studying music, I realized this was not going to satisfy me either. So I went back to get a degree in theology. And one of my professors said, I got a master's and at Windsor in Ontario. And one of my professors suggested I get a PhD in religion. And I told him I wanted nothing to do with religion. And he said, no, I know a place where you can study it and you don't have to worry about that. So I went to Syracuse, which had a wonderful program. It was just perfect for me, absolutely perfect. And they asked me to write a paper about how I thought it should be studied, and I did, and they gave me full tuition and a living expense and everything. I mean, it was just great. So I spent 3 years at Syracuse getting a PhD in religion.
And by this point, how old are you?
35. I feel like I've been in school.
Since you were 13
decades,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And is that when you went into practice?
No. I taught psychology for a year because that was that's a long story, but it was the only place I could get a job. Psychology really wasn't my thing. I never had a course in psychology actually, but I had studied Jung and I had taken some. Oh, I did take courses at Syracuse in counseling psychology. So I wanted to be prepared as a teacher to really be able to deal with my students well. It turned out later that I was able to use that coursework to become a therapist and get a license. So what I did was had an opportunity then to go to Southern Methodist University and teach religion, which was my field. And I moved over to that and taught there for 8 years, the usual length of time, when they decide to give you tenure or not. And they did not give me tenure.
Why is that?
Well, they told me there were two things. One was that I just never could write the academic papers that they wanted. To me, it was so dull.
Right, so stale.
It's not what I wanted to do. So I would write more popular stuff, and they didn't accept that. They didn't think that was good enough. And I also taught in ways that were more experimental or different from the usual. I was applying all that psychology.
Were other people teaching like that?
No, not really.
Were you alone? Were you sort of innovating? Did you feel like you were breaking new ground?
I didn't feel too much of that. I felt that there were other people doing I thought there were wonderful teachers around me. I didn't think I was any better than them. But I think for one thing, I was teaching a lot of people who ordinarily would not have any coursework on religion. And I thought it was important, like for the football players and people like that, the athletes, to have some courses. And I would give them passing grades if they just showed up, you know, if they would just sit in. And I think the administration didn't like that. They thought my grades were too high. So I think that was one of their complaints. I'm not really too sure. It was all a closed system. They had their own meeting and I was not invited. And then they came and told me, we don't want you anymore. So I don't know what happened.
See, what I find, and then where did you go? Because I find fascinating when you look at the arc of somebody's life.
Yeah.
You're at 13, you're studying to be a monk.
Right.
Then you leave that and you do music.
Right.
Then, like, I love it because your books have met so many, but have helped so many people. Your work has guided so many people, but the path to get there is nuts.
It is. But on the other hand, it fits my books pretty well.
Yeah, but then it all makes sense at the end.
Yeah, because what I did was I just listened to the voices of change. I mean, I listened to guidance, and might say. I mean, like when it came time to leave the monastery, as soon as I had that sense that it was over inside me, I was ready to go. I didn't want to pause and wait and wonder and...
Yes.
Give it time, but I just wanted to go.
That's exactly how do you. When one of the questions I get the most is how do you know when to go? How do you know when to leave? How do you know when to start something new? And I don't know if I've. My answer usually involves you just know or you. How do you answer those sorts of questions for people?
Rules. I don't think there are any rules for that. You have to just. You have to trust. I think trusting is the big thing. You trust. You have to learn, I guess, over time and through experiment to trust the voices of God. They're like, it's almost like you have a voice inside of you.
Yes.
That guides you, you know, tells you, don't go any further with this. That's how I felt. It was like a voice inside me saying, okay, you've done this, that's great, now it's time to do something else. And I trusted those things several times. So it was, I left the monastery, I was fired, you might say. I was denied tenure, and I took that as a signal to move into something new. I didn't know what to do. In both those instances, I didn't know what the future, I didn't know what to do in the future. It was just open. It was kind of scary in some ways. On the other hand, there was no choice. I just had to do it. So in the second case, when I was denied tenure, immediately people came to me and asked me to be a therapist for them. And I had had this training. I'd studied Jung very, very intensely and thoroughly because I really knew his stuff. And I had had this counseling psychology, which is Rogerian, which means I learned Carl Rogers' counseling, which is person-centered, which means that you listen very intensely to what people are saying. So I had that kind of mixed of those two different kinds of psychology behind me. And when people started asking me to be a therapist, it suddenly occurred to me, well, maybe that's a good way to do it. Maybe that's my next work. So I did that. I just opened up shop in a room in my house and began seeing clients. And it was wonderful. I did, and I'm still doing it after all these years.
And you had plenty of work.
I had enough to keep me going. I didn't go out looking for it, really. I wanted to write and study as well. So I had enough to keep me alive, yeah.
And what was your first book?
It's hard for me to know. I can't remember. I think the first book was a rewrite of my dissertation. Now that to me is an interesting topic. I don't know if it would be for you. But
what was the topic?
It was Renaissance astrology and magic.
Renaissance astrology and magic.
Yeah.
Everybody's talking about that.
Yeah, that's right. So.
And what were you saying about these topics?
Well, I discovered, first of all, I discovered a person who was writing in Florence in the 15th century. And he hadn't been translated. That's good if you want to write a dissertation, you know, to use primary material like that. So I translated one of his books. The book was called How to Design Your Life in Relationship to the Stars. It's like astrology, how to design your life according to the stars. And it was fascinating to me, and I still use it because it's he said that the soul was the center of life and you had to, well, essentially take care of your soul at first. And he suggested the first thing you should do is find out where to live. Like that's the most important thing for your soul, the first step, live in the right place.
Like geographically, like city or country or wherever.
Yeah, the region, neighborhood, house, the whole thing. Make sure you're living in the right place. And I thought that's really a good bit of advice. It's interesting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So he had all kinds of suggestions on that were used. He used astrological language primarily, although it was all soul-centered. He used the word soul all the time. And it was astrological, but it could be easily read psychologically. So my dissertation was a psychological reading of his astrology. This fellow's name is Ficino, Marsilio Ficino.
Marsilio Ficino.
Marsilio Ficino, yeah.
And you translated it from?
From Latin.
From the Latin.
Because I had studied Latin. You know, I had taken courses. When I was studying philosophy, when I was with the monks, the courses were taught in Latin. So
your Latin came back at that point.
Oh yeah.
And what's this other thing? Okay, live in the right place.
Yeah, live in the right
place. What else?
Well, he would suggest surrounding yourself with material, with things, objects that feed your soul. So you have to decide. His whole approach was you have to look at the world around you and decide what colors, what textures, what materials, what images are potent for you, that really work for you, and where you can select them and use them according to the mood you're in. Like, let's say you're depressed, if you're sad, you should know what kind of colors to wear and what how to paint your room and all that sort of thing. He even suggested, that the first practice you should do is look up your horoscope and then paint your horoscope on the ceiling of your bedroom so that when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you see is your destiny. It's like your the picture of who you are in a deep archetypal way. And I thought that was pretty interesting too, to have images. So see, that leads to a way of looking at art. So then from his point of view, art is not something you look at as entertainment. But the choice of art, like let's say paintings or music, just the music that you play during the day to listen to, should be chosen, he thought, to fit what your soul needs, like what your mood is and what you're going through, so that you actually nurture and take care of your soul through those kind of choices. So it wasn't this kind of analytical intellectual psychology. It was the psychology of the world.
And aesthetics.
And aesthetics was, but see, aesthetics then becomes a therapeutics at the same time. So that the aesthetic life is also therapeutic. It heals and it helps your emotional health.
Oh, this becomes your first book.
Yeah, my first book was called The Planets Within, and it's based on this, you know, the planets. It's based on this work of Ficino in astrology. It was based on...
I love book titles, and that's a great book title.
Yeah.
That's a really good book title.
Yeah, I like it.
So you're doing therapy with people at your house.
Yes.
You start writing books.
Yes.
And then Care of the Soul... is 1992?
Yeah, I think that was the fifth book or fourth or fifth, I forget which.
How often are you writing a book? Is it every year, every couple of years, a book coming out?
Since then?
At that point, early on.
Well, no, it wasn't quite as frequent then. And since then, since Care of the Soul, it's been almost every year, but not quite, but pretty close.
And I one of the things that I find most fascinating is how people do this for the long haul. One book is nice, but a number of books. Mm-hmm. And already, wherever we are in your sort of chronology, there's a curiosity at work there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Whether it's something written in Latin hundreds of years ago, whether it's... And is your form, like Care of the Soul, does that come out of your sitting with people and... you're doing therapy with them and you're learning and then ideas begin to take shape. Oh, this is a book here.
That's part of it. That certainly was the way Care of the Soul came to be. On the other hand, the other part of it is that my intellectual life is very important to me. So here I am reading, when I'm doing my dissertation, I'm reading this person who says that the soul is the very center of life and you have to care for it in very concrete ways. And he retranslates, he reimagines everything, like art now becomes therapy.
You know? Yes.
And religion is part of it. So the spiritual life is part of it as well. He was a priest as well and a theologian. So, you know, I put all that together because having been a monk in my own life, I've always tried to keep that monk's life alive in me all along. So all of the spiritual life is also a piece that's there. But since I left religion, I wasn't interested in going back to an old style of religious practice. What I've done since is I've studied, at Syracuse especially, I studied Greek religion, Greek, they call it mythology, I don't like that word too much.
For so many people, myth means not true.
Yeah.
As opposed to a larger...
Yeah, myth is not a good word. I think it's really a spirituality. It's a kind of spirituality. It's a polytheistic spirituality, which is wonderful because... that makes everything sacred. There's nothing in a polytheistic approach, spirituality, that is not sacred. There's a god or goddess or spirit for everything. There's a temple to everything. You name it, it's got a temple. So I like that. That makes everything, it recognizes the depth and the sacredness, the extreme value of everything we do, so that we don't just say, here's this life, this ordinary life we live, let's get out of it and go to some spiritual place.
Yes.
It's in the world. It's a spirituality in the world. I really like that.
And you've written a lot about that.
I've written a lot about that because I think that's really important. I think this division of spirituality from ordinary life really kills us.
Thank you. So the plumber listening says to you, there's nothing spiritual about me driving my truck around fixing pipes.
Uh-huh.
And you would say to him or her, where do you start helping people understand the sacred nature of their everyday?
First of all, I would want to talk to him about his calling, his work. Well, why is he drawn to this work? One thing about looking at the soul, working that way in the world, is that you have to take everything poetically. It can't be literal. You have to look deeper. So you say, well, let's say the plumber doing this work, you could say, well, how do you happen to be in this? A lot of plumbers are there because their parents were plumbers. And the family, they have a long tradition in the family. So you can see maybe that you right away start talking about one's relationship to the family tradition, values, and that's moving toward a spiritual viewpoint.
So just the very fact that you are doing this connects you with a tradition, and that alone
yes,
has a
that
has
alone
a certain...
is just one little piece of a whole big picture. You could also look at the poetics of it. You are helping people live their lives. Plumbing's very obviously important to everybody.
Yes.
You know,
the moment it's not working, we lose our minds.
Absolutely, it's hard to live without it, and it has to do with depth. You know, with a hidden world. It's a hidden world. My dad always told me about how he'd go to people's houses to fix their plumbing, and he'd have to open up their ceiling or their floors. And he said that he told me a lot of stories of things that he found while he was opening up, finding money, you know, stashed away somewhere, and things like that. So it's a hidden world, which is interesting because that's what I work with too. When I work with my psychotherapy, I'm looking at the hidden world. It's not usually too obvious. Most people are living their lives, but they're living out a lot of family life and conflicts that developed when they were children. There's a lot of hiddenness about life, and that's very much like plumbing. That's one aspect of plumbing.
I love it. Okay, for people who haven't read Care of the Soul, and I hope everybody goes out and buys it.
I hope so too.
How do you define the soul, or how do you talk about the soul and help people understand the centrality of the soul for life?
I think the best way is just describe. You can't really define that, but you can describe it as the soul is, first of all, it has certain qualities. The soul, a person has soul if they have a real presence, if they're real people. If you encounter somebody who is really there, they're not off thinking of something else, or they're not sort of batty, you know, they're really present. That's part of it.
I love it that you're a therapist and you just use the word batty.
and let's say another thing would be if people can relate. That's one of the powers of the soul. You can relate, you can connect. So if you're walking down the street and you see these people going past you, they don't even look at you. You wonder maybe. I mean, they could, who knows? But it could be that they're not present. You know, they don't make contact with the world. We do that a lot today. We don't connect with each other. And soul would be a description of when it's present, people connect and can have good relationships. That's part of it. Another part is that soul works primarily through pleasure, I think. So we're looking for pleasure, and if you want a really soulful evening, you have a pleasurable one. You know, it's not working. Excessive working doesn't seem to be very soulful. It's more of a spirit thing. It's more like you are trying to accomplish something for the future. But when you're living from the soul, you relax and you are present in the moment and the time you're in, and you relax into it and enjoy it. And the tradition is about soul. It's all these books that are written hundreds of years ago. So many say that the key thing about soul is friendship. So the most important pleasure to the soul is to be around friends, having a good time.
Really?
Yeah.
The number one thing?
Number one. Absolute number one.
Wow. Okay, so you're then seeing people. Then did you stay? Where did you move? You were in Texas at one point. Then where did you end up?
I was teaching at SMU. I was working. I had my practice in Texas. And I had many friends there. And by the way, one of my great friends and mentors is James Hillman, who was a Jungian analyst who I admired tremendously. He died about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And he and I were very close friends for 38 years, a long time. And I use his work for everything I do. I just think he was a genius, incredible genius. So he was living in Dallas, not at the university I was at, but he was there. And we did a lot together, and I learned a lot from him. And then at a point, I grew up in Michigan, and Texas didn't seem quite natural to me. For one thing, I couldn't find water. I couldn't find trees, ordinary trees. There were trees there, but they were little desert-type things, and I just didn't feel at home. And the customs of Texas were different to me. They were nice, and I appreciated Texas a great deal, but I didn't want to live there forever. So one day I just decided I should leave, and I packed up my things and left, and I just thought I'd give New England a try. It sounded to me like a good place, like I would really belong there. So I went up thinking I would get a job somewhere, and I didn't get any jobs, so I couldn't find one. So I began giving talks. I would put up a little notice in a library and say I was giving a talk on myth or depth psychology or something, and I would talk to 20 people. And that's when I wrote Care of the Soul. And that's what gave me work to do, the book. The book was successful. And so I had lots of work to do once I published that book.
So that book was written, you were literally going around New England putting up little signs.
Yeah, when I was writing that book. I had no money at all. I was single. I had no money. I would just go around and give these little talks. I had a little tiny therapy practice in a small village in Massachusetts. And I did a little work in Amherst, Massachusetts. I rented a little space there to do some therapy. That's what kept me going financially. It wasn't much, but it kept me going. But then when Care of the Soul came, I got a good contract for the book, which shocked me. You know, it was astonishing.
And why would they get, how did you get a good contract if you were just had a little practice in New England?
The people, the publishers saw the potential in the book. And I had a good agent.
I love these stories. I love it when somebody says, I had no money.
I had nothing. There was one point I looked in my wallet and I had $4. I did keep a little money, a few hundred dollars in the bank in case I needed to go and help out my parents. And they lived in Detroit. But other than that, I had nothing, really.
How old were you?
How old was I then? I must have been 40-something, 45 when I left Texas. I remember one time I had a rented house for a while, and my mother came to visit, my mother and dad. And my mother said, when are you going to buy your own furniture?
I love it. You wrote this classic book and you had $4 in your wallet.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
And then when the book came out, everything's changed.
Everything changed.
And then you were traveling and speaking and...
Well, also, just at the time of that book, just as I was writing it, I met the woman who would be my wife now. And we had a child very soon, my daughter, who was born Siobhan. Now she's taken a Sikh name, Ajit. So she's a singer now, and I homeschooled her in high school, for high school. So she's doing a lot of the work in her own way. She's picked up a lot over the years from me and from her mother. So she's kind of combining us and doing a lot. But to go back to that though, when I was single, it was okay to have nothing, but with children, you want to be able to support them and have them have good experiences. And so I was glad to have some money then.
Extraordinary. And then you kept writing.
I did.
And let's forward up to the latest book, mm-hmm. A Religion of One's Own. And what brought up, where did the seeds from this book come from?
Well, I think it was that as I travel and talk to people, so many people told me that they used to be involved in a church or temple or something, some form of religion. But they had given it up because they weren't exactly sure why. It just wasn't useful for them anymore. I think this is going on in our world now. People are just coming to a point, they can't even say why, but they're not interested in churches anymore. So many, some people are, but a great number of them are not. And so I thought I should write a book. I mean, religion is my field. I've been studying it for years, and I have a PhD in religion. So I thought I should write about how one can be religious today, which is very different from in past times. So what I tried to do was, really it's about two things. One is how you can use the information or the images and techniques and teachings from the world's religious traditions and spiritual traditions without doing it superficially. I think there's a way to do it that's really solid. And I've done that myself. I've really been involved with a lot of different religions. And the other thing was to see that there are certain practices you can do on your own, like going out in nature, or the work you do, you choose to do, or being ethically involved in your social world and all of that. That all together, though, all those elements make up a form of religion that's yours. It's not created by somebody else and you plug into them, but you create it yourself. You see what the options are. You learn from the many religious traditions, but you actually can create your own way. You can even do that if you're going to a church. You can still make it your own and have your own practices that flesh it out. So that's what I wanted to write about. How today, especially in today's world, you don't have to succumb to the secularism that's all around us. Our institutions are secular, and that means they're soulless, because if they're secular, they don't have a soul. That's how it works.
Oh, but that is so good.
Yeah.
So, secular means without a soul.
Yeah. I mean, full secular. What I want to do is combine the so-called secular world with the spiritual world or the secular world and have them one.
Yes. Thank you.
And so you look at me, you look at my life. I don't look like I have any spiritual practice now. I don't dress in any special way. I don't go to a church or anything. I mean, my work is my religion, really. I'm writing all these substantive books about spiritual life and the soul. And I go speaking all over the world about it. So that's my religion today.
Yes, I often talk about how the whole thing is a temple.
Absolutely, the whole thing is a temple, the whole thing.
My wife and I started a church when we were 28, and it got very, very big.
Wow.
And it was amazing to be a part of.
Yeah.
And then when I left being a pastor in a local church, I often talk about you spend lots of energies building a temple only to discover that the whole thing is a temple.
That's right.
It's all holy. It's all sacred.
That's right. It's all sacred.
And what is happening? Some have called it age of spirit. What is happening in the collective consciousness in this time? I mean, I know every major new technology spurs something in how people interact with spirit. So some would say with internet, we're now seeing something new happening. But what would you say is happening with an awakening to the holy sacred nature? Is it just a backlash against the cold reductionism that says there is no soul, essentially?
Yeah, I think part of it is a reaction. Yeah, because you can't live. I forget who it was that said, you know, human beings can't live without some sort of spiritual practice. Ficino said that religion is as natural to a human being as barking is to a dog. I mean, it's a natural thing, and that's how I see it. It's a natural expression, and if you don't do it, you're in trouble. If you don't have, I know the word religion is not popular today. That's one reason why this recent book, I think, hasn't sold as well as I had hoped. People have told me they don't like the word religion, and they think I'm proposing that they go back to some religious institution. So the title can be misleading, I guess. It doesn't feel that way to me, but people are telling me that. So I'm cautious using the word religion for it, although to me it's the best word, because I'm just adapting it to a different way of doing it. So to me, there's continuity for me. I started out in religion in a formal way in a church and monastery and all of that. Today, if you look at my life, my writing and my being a father and homeschooling my daughter and all that kind of thing are all part of my religious
practice. There's a path, there's an order, there's almost a liturgy to it.
Yeah, there is.
It's just an actual real world.
It's a real
flesh and blood experience.
It's a real world experience, absolutely. So just because it's that way doesn't mean it's not holy and sacred. It is for me. So I want to be able to live a life where you look at me and you can't see the religion in it, but it's really there everywhere, saturated with it.
Yes.
That's what I like. That's my ideal. Now, my wife is different. My wife and daughter now are Sikhs, and they wear turbans, and they get up early in the morning, and they have prayers that they say, and meditations that they do, and yoga practices. So I'm not saying, I mean, they're doing it beautifully, I think. It's wonderful. But I'm not the same. I've chosen a different way of doing it. So I don't want to say that those formal ways are not good. They are. They're wonderful. But my way also is available. I think it's a model.
And what kinds of questions, when you've gone out and talking about this book, what kind of questions? I always laugh that on any time I do a book and you go out and talk about it, there's 7 questions. And then you go do a different book and there's a different set of questions.
That's true. That's right. The first question that people ask me these days is, what about community? If you're doing a religion of your own, then what about community? Because they see that the churches, the advantage of the churches is you've got a community. People are working together. There's a lot of support. So my answer to that is that if you're doing this religion of your own, you will have community, but you have to define it differently. It won't be people coming to a building, people thinking alike and going through, you know, having parties and meetings and that kind of thing. It will be encountering people now, perhaps online or through an email or Facebook, or there are different ways in which, because of your interests and their passions for this, trying to create your own way, your own path, you might say, you can establish really valuable and intense relationships with people through that. But it's different. It's not that same physical centrality that you would find in a church.
It strikes me how many churches are starting like neighborhood groups where let's get everybody together with a barbecue and we'll get them talking. And it's like, or you could just live in a neighborhood and get to know your neighbors.
Right.
Like you join an institution that then spends all of its energy trying to deconstruct itself to get you back to you and some friends just living your lives together.
Well, I feel that way. I don't see any need to create the formal institution. Although I do think that my feeling is that, let's say, the Catholic Church that I grew up in, it's having difficulties these days. I mean, the churches are closing down and they're empty or they're just full of people over 75. And I think that they could be resurrected and renewed. I think really think they could be, but they would have to be. It would have to be radically different.
A true resurrection.
Yeah, they could be, and they could respond to the needs of people today. But it would mean a really looking at themselves and changing in ways that they never thought they could do. That they've got such a weight, a heavy weight that they just drag along like a huge anchor that keeps it down. Like you have to do, you know, no married priests, you know, and no married clergy, and teaching these doctrines and using this holier-than-thou language, all that kind of thing. I think all that could go out the window. And they could be renewed and have tons of people coming to them. Where they could be resources for people whose main job is to create their own spirituality, and be on their own spiritual path, be supported by the churches. Instead of turning everything over to them and say, here, I surrender, do with me what you want. I think those days are over.
Yeah. Yeah, oh yeah. So what are you thinking about now? What's brewing now?
Well, a number of things are brewing for me. I have a number of books coming out this next year. Care of the Soul and Soulmates are going to be out in 25th anniversary editions. And I've written a new chapter for each one.
Nice.
So that's nice. And I've written a book on Christmas. that to me fits what we were just talking about. It's Christmas for everybody, you know, atheists, Buddhists, whoever. Nice. And I present it in such a way that Christmas has real meaning, but it's not just Christian meaning. It could be certainly partly Christian, but it's universal. That's one thing I've done. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm writing a book now which is just taking shape. Actually, I've written most of it, but it started out as a book on aging. But a lot of people ask me to write about aging. And a lot of people in their 50s are very concerned about getting older today. And so I wanted to write about that. I think it's a radical idea about it, so I want to write that, but my agent tells me that he thinks the book should be not just about aging in the typical way, but it should be about anyone, whatever age, going through movement and changes in life as they get older, no matter how old you are. So let's say someone in their 20s may have to face a lot of issues of aging, actually. So that's what I'm writing about, how throughout the whole lifespan, how we have to always move toward being aged. I think of it as like wine or cheese that's aged, not just adding up years, but like it gets better, you know? Like
yes.
You're in a process where you as a person become richer and better and more interesting as you go. That's really it's that process that I'm writing about.
Fantastic. I love it. And you still see people?
I do. I see people. I don't. I say see. Most of my contacts now are on telephone or Skype. I do see a couple of people in person, but most of the people I work with now are at a distance.
And like one last question: how, if there's one thing that if people saw it or understood it or experienced it, you would have way less work.
Oh, yeah. The way I put it sometimes is that the people I see, I think, are not afraid of dying. They're afraid of living. So I think that the key to being able to not be neurotic is to step out of the way and let life live through you. Like, let the life that is in you be realized in you. But to do that, you have to get out of the way of it. You have to cooperate rather than create. I don't believe this idea. I know a lot of people are teaching it today, where you create your own life. You make your own life as you go. I don't think that's the way it works. I think what you do is you cooperate with the life that was in you from the very beginning. My friend Hillman says this idea about acorns, that we started out like an acorn and we have everything we are right there at the beginning, and it unfolds like out of a seed. I think that's correct. We've got everything, and you have to be in a receptive mode. You have to let things happen. One of the things I wrote in I think was in A Religion of One's Own, that I had a calendar, a Taoist calendar, that on the cover it said, "Let things take their course." That to me was kind of a guide from my year. That year I loved it. That the principle was to let things happen. Don't force it. Don't think you know everything. You have to be able to step out of the way, let life that is in you unfold, and you cooperate and you enjoy making a life, but you're not fabricating the whole thing. You are helping it as it opens up from within you.
Yes. The great German theologian Jürgen Moltmann has this line about an impelling force.
Yeah.
As opposed to something external from you pulling you, it comes from within.
That's right.
And you follow it, you are pulled along.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sitting down. Thank you for all the books and wisdom and guidance.
Well,
and
thank you for understanding so much. That's great.
Having you on the Robcast is great. So everybody, Thomas More. All the books are available wherever fine books are sold. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
Grace and peace, everyone.